plans to entirely upend this hackneyed conventional wisdom. Yes, having a child is more expensive than not having a child, but it doesn't have to cost anywhere near the egregious sums I see headlining clickbait scare tactic articles designed to send already apprehensive pregnant women, neurotically scanning the internet while inhaling ice cream, speaking for myself here, into near panic attacks. By the time we finally got pregnant in March 2015, Nate and I had figured out how to apply extreme frugality to every aspect of our lives. We reasoned parenthood shouldn't be any different. Once you've ingrained the mindset of frugality and reaped the multitude of benefits the lifestyle offers, it's actually more difficult to spend money than not. There's an assumption that parenting is somehow impossible to square with frugality. But let me ruin the rest of the book and divest you of this notion right now. It's not. There's a stigma associated with used baby things, and yes, babies are expensive if you care what other people think about your diaper bag and burp cloths. Nate and I learned that the stuff of babies, the rockers, bouncers, and changing tables, was all around us, in the attics and basements of everyone we knew with kids slightly too old to sleep in a crib any longer. Before we even got pregnant, my friend at work mentioned that she needed to transition her youngest son into a big boy bed and that she didn't know what to do with his crib and changing table, since she couldn't sell the crib, an old drop-side model on Craigslist. She figured she'd have to throw it out. My frugal antenna went up, way up, and I asked her if I could have it. Nate and I took the minivan over to her house one Sunday and spent the afternoon disassembling the crib and changing table and squeezing them into the back of the van. We'd long since taken all the rear seats out of the minivan, rendering it a sort of pickup truck with a roof, because either we or our friends were forever hauling furniture, or 2x4s, or, in one memorable instance while dog-sitting, 3 greyhounds. As Nate worked to take apart the crib, my friend and her husband, thrilled we were carting away this old stuff, asked if we wanted any other baby things. She pulled out a high chair, car seat, changing pads, clothes, crib sheets, toys, books, a gold mine of hand-me-downs. She was surprised we wanted all this old stuff, but delighted to unload it. Nate and I stored this stash in our upstairs guest room, where I wouldn't see it and weep during my un-pregnancy, for almost a year and a half before our daughter was born. Housing the stuff for so long was worth it to us, for what turned out to be a nursery we spent all of $20 on. Baby things are like Christmas trees. When it's in season, you really want it. But once that season is over, you want it out of your house like yesterday. Once I was pregnant, I put out the word to friends, neighbors, co-workers, anyone I knew with kids, that I'd happily take their hand-me-downs. Most of them were initially surprised that I wanted used things, since, as an upper-middle-class urban couple expecting their first precious child, it was assumed we'd want to buy brand-new, top-of-the-line baby gear. After people heard I'd take their cast-offs, a motherload of baby goods came pouring in. I also joined my local Buy Nothing group, which was a bastion of baby and kid stuff. I started cleaning out our basement and gave away wedding gifts we'd never opened, picture frames, throw pillows, and anything else we didn't need in exchange for bibs, clothes, blankets, books, toys, a stroller, swaddles, a bassinet, and more. All well used and all completely free. The insidious thing about new baby paraphernalia is that manufacturers and marketers know they're dealing with a vulnerable, susceptible demographic. Expectant parents. If there's a more anxiety-provoking time than being pregnant with your first child, I'd like to hear about it. Because you are now weighted with the gravity of knowing you're going to be responsible for another person, a life you've created. After all, don't you want what's best for your child? What's safest? What's most likely to ensure their spot in Harvard's class of 2037? Any special occasion or life event is an advertiser's dream, and weddings, graduations, and funerals are all ripe for cowing participants into spending way more than they can afford because, as the ads taunt, you deserve it, and everyone else is doing it, and don't you want to honor your loved ones? The golden goose of all is the baby industrial complex. The pressure is so compelling that if Nate and I weren't already secure, confident, and well-practiced in our frugality, I would have been sucked right into the fray. As it was, I was firmly off the consumer carousel and suspicious of claims that used baby stuff was gross or unsafe. These ads play on our basest fears that we won't be able to provide for our children, that they'll get sick, that they'll be unhappy. But buying stuff doesn't mitigate any of those concerns. If anything, it enhances them, since by buying tons of stuff, we'll have less money to deal with potentially serious issues, such as an unexpected health crisis. There are very real safety considerations with baby goods, so I'm not recommending that anyone go all 1820s on their child and forego modern conventions like sleep sacks and car seats. Merely that you use your brain. I know my brain took a hiatus during pregnancy, but bear with me. Nate and I accepted a hand-me-down car seat, an action that's cited as the ultimate parenting sin. However, we took that car seat from a trusted friend who told us the seat hadn't ever been in an accident. We then researched the serial number and manufacturer and determined the seat wasn't expired and that there were no safety recalls or innovations. In other words, it was a perfectly fine free car seat. Same story for our high chair, which did in fact have a safety recall, so we ordered the parts to fix it from the manufacturer, which, by the way, were free. And as for that drop-side crib, my friend had already installed the conversion kit that turned it into a safe fixed-side crib. I probably wouldn't use a 20-year-old car seat, but a 2-year-old seat? Absolutely. We also played the long game in assembling our nursery, which is the heart of successful hand-me-downing. You can't expect to find everything you need in a day, a week, or even a month. It takes time to curate an entirely second-hand home, but as someone who has done it, I can tell you it's altogether possible. Plus, the thrill of the hunt is unparalleled. When you walk into a store and buy everything you could possibly need, you deprive yourself of the unadulterated providence of happening upon just the extra saucer you need sitting for free on the side of the road. There's no rush quite like it. My dear friend Tori asked if she could host a baby shower for us, and I was conflicted by her offer. On one hand, it was an incredibly sweet gesture, and a shower would be a lot of fun. But on the other hand, I didn't want to condemn my friends to buying brand new stuff for me when I knew I could find the things I needed for free or cheap on the used market. It felt unfair and out of alignment with my frugal ethos, and so I asked Tori if she would instead be willing to keep our dog for us when we went to the hospital to have our baby. She very kindly agreed. Tori explained that she wanted to do something to support us during this time, and if dog sitting was what we needed, then she would do it. Foregoing a registry and baby shower might be unconventional, but it worked for me, and it made me feel like I was able to keep true to my anti-consumer goals. Plus, we genuinely needed a dog sitter, and were grateful to be able to take Tori up on her generosity. Frugality also eliminates the paralysis by analysis that's endemic to buying new. If we'd decided to buy everything new, hours of our lives, and a fair bit of sanity would have been lost to comparing the merits of a City Mini versus a Snap and Go and an Ergo versus a Snuggly. By taking whatever came our way for free, the time and stress endemic to making these choices was eliminated. More choices do not lead to more happiness. In fact, research has proven the exact opposite. When we're overwhelmed with the 67 different styles of baby onesies, we're not going to be satisfied with our choice. No matter what, we'll wonder if we chose the wrong one. We'll second-guess our decision and compulsively read reviews to see if we're vindicated in our selection. Conversely, I was thrilled with any and all free baby onesies because I didn't have to labor over selecting them. Didn't hurt that I didn't pay for them either. We're led to believe that having the ability to select between multiple options is a boon, but in reality, any time we choose stuff over our circumstances, we're losing. The real freedom of choice is to turn our backs on consumption. You're not exerting your free will and spending money. You're turning your free will over to someone else. Choice is the ultimate freedom we have, yet so many of us put choice of material possessions ahead of choice over how we spend our lives. In addition to decreasing our happiness level, endless choices also ratchet up our spending. If the $300 stroller is good, then the $375 model must be better. And we're now reading through the 276 customer reviews, and it looks like people actually prefer the $425 model, which comes with a cup holder. Open a few more tabs, and it seems that there was an improvement made at the $450 level, and so maybe that would be best. although actually the $556 model is the one with 5 stars. And on it goes. Our unfettered access to massive data sets, scrolling customer reviews, and online forums has created an unrealistic expectation of exhaustive research before buying a single solitary thing. Purchasing a bib turns into a hair-tearing, nightmarish landscape of horror stories about babies smeared with irrevocably staining beet juice. Side note, beets really do stain babies something awful. Is my high chair the best, most perfect, highest-rated high chair ever designed for babies? Probably not. But it works mighty fine, and I wasted none of this time and mental energy. I just picked it up for free one afternoon from Nate's colleague, whose kids had outgrown it. And I actually like this high chair quite a bit, as it's cute, it's functional, and it cleans up well. I'd wager I appreciate it all the more because of the embodied time, stress, and cost that it doesn't represent. Plus, what's new today will probably be recalled or changed or otherwise modified for the next buying season to ensure we continue worshiping at the altar of eternal consumption. I didn't suspend my own personal clothes buying ban during pregnancy either. I figured if I could find so many baby things secondhand, surely I could source hand-me-down maternity clothes too. And I did. Everything from nursing tank tops to maternity cocktail dresses came my way for free as hand-me-downs. Maternity clothes that you wear only for a few months tops? Total rip-off. My collection of hand-me-downs weren't all perfect, weren't all my style, weren't all my size, and some were downright shabby. But they were all free, and they all worked just fine. I managed to look professional every day at my job, plus requisite work cocktail parties, participate in several conferences, go to a family reunion, and attend a wedding while pregnant, all without buying a scrap of clothing. Babies have this penchant for not caring about anything but eating, sleeping, and snuggling on their parents. Whether that's in a crib that 3 other children have already slept in, or a brand new $1,400 contraption, is immaterial to them. The only person who cares what the crib looks like are the parents. If I'd spent thousands of dollars before my child was even born, what exactly would that portend for the rest of her life? Hundreds of dollars on a new preschool wardrobe? Thousands of dollars on school supplies for kindergarten? A pony for a 7th birthday? Start off from the perspective of spending as little as possible, and you'll have more resources at your disposal to pay for the things that actually matter later on in a child's life. Nate and I found that using secondhand baby things and eschewing the idea that more stuff makes a happier kid did not create a sense of deprivation. For us, it became not only an economical choice, but also a way of teaching our child how to value ingenuity over consumption and people over things. As we prepared for our child's birth, I realized that instead of spending time shopping or working longer hours to earn more money to buy more stuff for our kid, Nate and I were going to circumvent that entire system and instead simply spend more time with our child. As Nate and I discussed our nascent parenting philosophy, we agreed that what kids truly need and want is time with their parents to help them learn, grow, and explore the world. For our family, thousands of dollars spent on the latest educational toys could not replace an hour-long, free walk through the park together to explore the grass, talk about the trees, and comment on a squirrel burying a nut. Nate and I decided that what our kid needed most was us. Not us distracted and harried by jobs, struggling to pay for expensive trappings of childhood, but our presence, our imperfections, our dreams, our unique skills, our unhurried ears, and most of all, our love. Our lives were enriched and made demonstrably better thanks to our embrace of frugality. We figured that a kid would reap those same benefits. 12. That one time we bought a homestead. Nate and I sat side by side on our couch drinking coffee, scrolling through available properties in Vermont on Nate's laptop, me leaning over my baby bump to peer at the acreage listed on the screen, an exercise we'd performed for nearly 2 years, minus the baby bump, obviously. After scanning everything that fit our parameters on this fall day in 2015, Nate opened up a new tab, saying he'd saved one for last. It was a property in a town we'd never heard of before, in a part of the state we'd never been to, with more land and house than we thought we could afford. Didn't hurt that the home was gorgeous and the barn perfectly rendered. I was smitten. We had to go see it. As we learned in our year and a half of searching, there weren't many places that met our criteria for a move-in ready home and outbuildings with over 20 acres of forested land in a good school district on a main road not too far from a medium/large city for under $400,000. Not that we were picky or anything. Every few months, Nate and I would pop up to Vermont to tour properties with our long-suffering real estate agent. This search was a lot more laborious and tactile than our city house hunt because there are no open houses for rural homes. There's a much smaller inventory, and there are a multitude of factors to consider that don't exist in urban and suburban neighborhoods. The septic system, the well, yes, like the one you get water from, the quality of the forest, since forests are a commodity, the driveway, the road, the siting of the home and outbuildings relative to the rest of the land, the presence/absence of neighbors, the acreage, the surrounding community, the distance to the grocery store, all this before ever stepping foot inside a house. Nate and I wanted to buy a property that we loved, that we could envision ourselves living on for decades to come, and perhaps for the rest of our lives. And we didn't want to overpay, and we didn't want to build new, since it's nearly impossible to recoup the expense of building on account of the site work that's required in a rural setting. Digging a septic system and a well, putting in a driveway, plus the cost of the raw land to begin with. Given all this, and in spite of my advanced pregnancy, we had to go see this property. "The map says there's a road here, and that we're supposed to turn left on it," I relayed to Nate, not very convincingly, as he nosed the car toward what you might charitably call a footpath through pole after pole of trees. This thing was less of a road than most hiking trails I'd been on. We were driving in that 19-year-old minivan through the apparent Bermuda Triangle of rural central Vermont. It was 5 p.m. in late October 2015, and I was a full 8 months pregnant. It was also raining, the sun was setting, and our gas gauge was flirting with empty, although in that car it was always hard to tell since the gauge had stopped working properly sometime after we clocked 200,000 miles. Usually you had less gas than it appeared. We hadn't passed a house in at least 15 minutes. We had no cell reception, and our GPS would have been more useful if we'd asked it to recite the Declaration of Independence. We came to a gravel road that was slightly larger and more prominent looking than the road we'd been on, so we decided to follow it downhill because that seemed more promising, not to mention more navigable than going uphill. Just as I was about to get out and hike back to a farmhouse we'd seen off in the distance, over a mountain that was more of a small hill, really, we turned onto a genuine street, denoted by the fact that it was paved, and into a gas station with a deer carcass hanging in front of the porta-potty that served as their restroom for customers only. Aside from the terror mingled with frustration we'd felt when circling for a third time onto Woodchuck Hollow Road, which was decidedly not paved, and let's be honest, road was a generous descriptor. Nate and I were giddy. We'd just toured what I was pretty certain was our future homestead. Back in spring 2014, we also thought we'd found our future homestead. We visited that property no less than 3 times with our real estate agent, the final trip with the seller and his agent as well. Our erstwhile dream home sat on 69 acres of forested southern Vermont landscape with streams bisecting the woods and a pristine view of the Green Mountains. The home, designed by a renowned architect, was energy efficient and meticulously laid out. Efficiency appeals to Nate and me at our very core, so we were enthralled with the thoughtful footprint and modern design of the house. There was just one teeny tiny hiccup. The interior was unfinished. And by unfinished, I mean the floors, walls, and ceilings were clad in nothing more than plywood. Naked beams arched across the living room's cathedral ceiling. Not in a trendy way. And the bathrooms had rudimentary plumbing, exposed pipes, toilets, and not much else. We spied an opportunity to finish the interior according to our tastes, with the benefit of having the expensive and boring site work of well, septic, foundation, roof, exterior, insulation, driveway, plumbing, and electrical already done. Since we'd have to sink thousands into finished work, we were willing to pay only a very specific price that was pretty far south of the asking price. Securing a conventional mortgage on an unfinished house is nearly impossible, and we didn't want a construction loan because it'd hamstring us from doing the work ourselves. We made an all-cash offer, which was yet another benefit of our frugality. The seller, however, saw the house as it should be, a finished, energy-efficient, Architectural Digest cover story. It was very much an Emperor's New Clothes scenario. In the end, we walked away. Nate and I are dreamers, but we're anchored by intense practicality. We'd offered the maximum price we were ready to write a check for, and when that was turned down, we decided this house was not for us. Our real estate agent was shocked we wouldn't stretch our budget or consider owner financing or a construction loan, but our conviction was ironclad that we didn't want to saddle ourselves with a homestead we couldn't afford. There was no point in overspending on our dream of pursuing a simple, inexpensive life. After this first heartbreak, we kept right on searching. We'd looked at real estate long enough to know there's never just one right home. It's easy to get swept up in the drama of betrothing yourself to a house, imagining where you'll put your couch and which wall you'll track your child's height on. But buying a home is as much a financial undertaking as an emotional one. In addition to in-person jaunts up to Vermont, Nate and I educated ourselves on the nuances of rural properties. Nate learned how to locate property boundaries in online maps, how to assess where power lines run, sometimes right next to the house, about different types of septic and well systems, how to determine the maturity of a forest, and more. Some of the places we considered were less than conventional, like the former commune lacking a kitchen, a half-log cabin slash half-house that the owner had added on to, and a hunting camp with linoleum on the walls. We'd also seen quite a few attractive listings we'd seriously considered, but ultimately disqualified for various reasons. You could see the neighbor's house. We wanted to be remote. There wasn't enough acreage. There were no outbuildings. One home had a 2-mile-long winding driveway leading to a house perched at the apex of a mountain. Good for views, but not for much of anything else. Or, as happened in several instances, the surrounding town and school district weren't vibrant. Given our year and a half of research, this newfound dream homestead seemed almost too good on paper, which made us fairly certain there'd be some hidden flaw. Probably it didn't have indoor plumbing, or was missing half its roof, or was inhabited by a family of black bears. Nevertheless, we decided to drive north for one final pre-baby homestead hunting trip, which was as much baby moon vacation as legitimate house hunt, because there's no way you find your dream homestead when you're 8 months pregnant with your first child, right? It was a chilly, clear, late October day, and the sky was cloudless, brilliant, almost otherworldly blue. Most of the trees had already completed their annual shed in preparation for winter, but enough tardy leaves remained to reward us with a slam of vermilion or saffron or amber every few yards. As we walked up to the house, a few of those late leaves swirled around, crunching beneath our citified feet, which were so accustomed to the confinement of concrete and not the soft give of earth. The house was even better than the pictures. Fairly new construction, wide expanses of open floor plan, 4 bedrooms, 3 bathrooms, custom woodwork and wood floors throughout, windows on every wall, new insulation, and no obvious faults. The real estate agent who showed us the home clearly doubted our intentions and abilities as homestead buyers, seeing as we were so pregnant, so urban, and so young. Nate and I stayed overnight at a nearby Airbnb and came back the next day to hike the land by ourselves, which was a ritual we'd performed with every other potential homestead that had passed our initial inspection. We needed to feel the woods surrounding a home and be present in them on our own, since we were making this move as much for the land as for the house. This property was a 66-acre parcel of forest, apple trees, gardens, streams, fields, and a pond. The owners were prolific vegetable gardeners, and we could see the outline of their labors in the lower field below the house. Bed after bed of now dormant gardens awaited new tending. On that much land, with that much raw potential, the possibilities were almost overwhelming. There was a trail next to the house leading into the woods, which was a dense mix of firs and hardwoods, and we set out on it. We hiked uphill, crossing a stream to what we calculated was the top corner of the land. I jumped up on a stump to look around. I could see acres of trees in every direction with deep autumnal hues and stark branches interrupted by the sublime green of pines. It was as beautiful as any hike in any national park. To think we could own this land, own these woods, was almost incomprehensible in its wonder. Hand in hand, we walked back down to the house and went on a circuit through the 2-acre clearing surrounding the house and barn, more city park than lawn. We found a grove of apple trees close to the house, neglected and unharvested for the season as the owners had already moved away. Nate picked 2 apples, and we walked up to the wide wooden plank back porch. Sitting on that porch, with warm afternoon sun streaming down on us, eating apples from trees not 50 feet away, I started crying, because I knew. This was it. This was our home. We hadn't intended to find it the month before our daughter was due. Common sense was screaming not to do it, not to make such a major decision on top of a major life change. But there was no helping it. We were hopelessly in love with this property. And the clincher? It had high-speed fiber internet. Internet access is not a given with rural properties, and this one had the crown jewel of fiber, which had been run to the house at no small expense by the previous owners, and came courtesy of a non-profit municipal collective dedicated to bringing broadband connectivity to rural central Vermont. The next month, Nate and I alternated between conducting due diligence research on the property and a frenetic cleaning, organizing, and reorganizing of our home in preparation for our baby. We'd long since set up our entirely secondhand nursery because I had intense paranoia about the baby arriving early and us not being ready. I made Nate install the car seat when I was 5 months pregnant. My motto was that no one has ever regretted being overprepared for a baby. Despite our emotional attachment to this homestead, we weren't about to dive into making an offer without first running it through our own personal vetting process. Realtors can tell you only so much about a place, and in the end, you're the one who has to live with the decision. Nate and I divvied up the tasks of researching both the property and the surrounding area. We were, in the simplest terms, trying to figure out if there was a smoking gun, something sinister and wrong with this seemingly perfect property. The undertaking we were considering was substantial and amounted to a lot more than just buying a home. Some factors, such as the health of the septic system and the well, wouldn't be revealed to us until the home inspection. But there was quite a few other variables we could research on our own. There were 3 reasons prompting our month of exhaustive independent research. 1. We wanted to live in this home for decades and didn't want to uncover a catastrophic con after moving in. 2. Unlike our city home, which had appreciated tremendously over the years, we'd consider this property worth exactly $0 in our overall net worth since rural land isn't guaranteed to appreciate or even remain constant. It's not at all uncommon for houses to sit on the market for years at a time in rural locations due to a lack of demand. We never planned to get our money back on this property, so we wanted to be sure it was what we truly wanted. This wasn't a financial investment as much as it was the achievement of an emotional goal. For that reason, we wanted to be certain we loved it and could see ourselves living there for a very long time. With our Cambridge home, we'd been willing to overlook quite a few negatives because it was such a sound financial investment. We wouldn't have that knowledge to fall back on with this property. 3. The size and scope of this homestead, along with its unusual rural location, created a prodigious list of factors to take under consideration, including the climate, our ability to maintain the quarter-mile-long driveway, the proximity of medical services, the nearest grocery store, the community, the health of the forest, the siting of the home and barn, any legal regulations governing the property. Rural land is often enrolled in a conservation or preservation program, which is usually a good thing, but can hinder an owner's ability to build or change things on the property. The local school district, the churches/libraries/community services and events in the area, and of course, all the things you normally consider when buying a home, such as the construction, layout, and integrity of the structure itself. Adding gravity to this research was the fact that our family was on the precipice of expansion, and we needed to figure out if this was a place where our child could thrive. Thankfully, our years of vetting Vermont properties came in handy. We thought we knew what questions to ask. I got on the phone with the local school district, the elementary school, and the public library in an effort to suss out what types of activities were provided and how people felt about their local institutions. I asked about class sizes, arts and music, cultural events, diversity, the curriculum, and everything else I could possibly think of to ask a prospective school. To the extent possible, I wanted to know who our neighbors would be and what opportunities our child would have in this bucolic rural town. I Googled doctors, dentists, pediatricians, grocery stores, and every other service I could imagine us needing to avail ourselves of. I mapped the driving distances to the nearest hospital, the nearest preschool, and more. Meanwhile, Nate hunted down foresters, lawyers who'd previously litigated on the property, and the owner once previous to the sellers. If at all possible, speaking with the previous owner of a home, but not the person trying to sell it to you, is a fabulous way to garner high-quality, unbiased, unvarnished advice. Nate's research was aimed at learning more about the 66 acres of land we wanted to own, what jurisdictions governed the property, how stable the forest was, and if there was anything that threw the property into an unfavorable legal light since a number of land parcels had been combined in order to create the now singly owned acreage. Our intense research turned up nothing nefarious. So, we decided to move forward. It was November 23rd, and our due date was November 25th. We debated waiting until after the baby was born, and until after the new year, perhaps. But we couldn't. The sellers had just lowered the price again, and we didn't want to risk waiting. I lay on our couch with a pillow underneath my knees, hugging my bump of a baby about to be born, my feet in Nate's lap, and we deliberated. What it finally came down to after hours of research, phone calls, and internet stalking was this question. How would you feel if someone else bought it tomorrow? I started crying, and that settled it. We made an offer on a house, a barn, and 66 acres of wild, wild woods located in a deeply rural town of barely 400 residents, the week our baby was due to join us. Because what else could we do? We'd planned, prepared, researched, and saved hundreds of thousands of dollars. This was our moment to strategically strike. There's no gain in indecision, in never taking a risk, in constantly wondering what your life would be like if you did what your heart calls you to do. Never acting on a dream is almost as bad as not having a dream in the first place. That all sounds well and good, doesn't it? But in truth, I was terrified. Terrified. I was about to give birth and was signing myself up for God knows what in God knows where, middle of nowhere, freaking deer-covered woodlands where I knew not a single soul. The closest neighbors were half a mile away. As fate would have it, I had precious little time to panic because I went into labor. 13. Birth. Something that never goes according to plan. I woke up at 5 a.m. on Monday, November 30th, 2015, with mild discomfort in my lower abdomen. I turned onto my side in bed and wondered what to do. I was 5 days past my due date, but I'd always assumed the start of labor would be accompanied by unambiguous pain, screaming, and a desire to breathe via panting. I felt none of that. It was more of a meek, crampy resonance below my bump. So I Googled early labor on my phone while Nate snoozed unaware. I saw no point in prematurely waking a man whose life was about to radically change. When our alarm went off as usual at 6 a.m., I told Nate that something was definitely happening. He leapt out of bed and asked what he should do. I told him to take the dog out and make breakfast. I had an app on my phone to track contractions, so I started punching the buttons for time and duration. I don't know how people tracked this stuff before technology. The idea of doing math at that moment in time seemed about as possible as riding in the Tour de France. I enacted the ironclad first, and really only, part of my birth plan. Take a shower. I have a thing about being clean. I once showered before going to the ER to have a softball-sized sprained ankle examined, and I was absolutely showering before giving birth. The only problem was that I had to keep opening the shower door and stabbing with wet hands at my phone, which was sitting on the bathroom sink, in order to track the contractions. That charade finally over, I dressed in my going-to-the-hospital clothes, which I'd had laid out for a good month and a half, and ordered Nate into the shower. I called my doctor to explain the situation, and she asked, in what I now realize was a tone of alarm, how far away from the hospital I was. It was only 7 a.m., and I'd assumed we'd be home for hours to come, days even. But she said it would be a good idea for me to come in now, because, first baby or not, things were progressing rapidly. I gathered my bag, packed for weeks, naturally, and tried to eat breakfast, a ludicrous concept at this point. By now, the pain had escalated to the level of confirming that this was labor. Even to a neophyte laborer, and the entire 10-minute ride to the hospital, I grabbed Nate's arm and asked how far away we were. This, despite the fact that I knew exactly where we were, as the hospital was basically in our neighborhood. I shot eyeball daggers at all the other drivers. How could they be on the road, sipping their coffee thermoses, listening to NPR at a time like this? Ever on the lookout for savings, Nate and I had planned in advance to park the minivan somewhere on a street close to the hospital, since it's in Cambridge, and as city residents, we were entitled to free street parking. This to avoid the $7 per day hospital parking garage fee. But as we neared the hospital, I used several expletives to tell Nate where he would be parking. In the parking garage, in a spot closest to the door. I bolted from the car, leaving Nate to straggle in with our bags. We were met by our labor and delivery nurse, Karen, whom I am certain can only be described as an angel. Karen settled us into a birthing suite, and we got comfortable, thinking we'd be there for hours. I decided to hold off on getting an epidural since I thought natural birth was for me. After all, I'd hiked a 4,000-foot mountain when I was 6 months pregnant and went to a 90-minute heated vinyasa flow yoga class the day before going into labor. 10 minutes later, I was moaning into Karen's scrubs-covered shoulder and alternating between begging for an epidural and chewing on my bedsheet. The epidural, accompanied by an entire team, came swiftly and was every bit as magical as lore had promised. I settled into bed feeling in control again and directed Nate to text everyone I thought we could reasonably inform of our current life status. Karen and my doctor were in and out of the room, checking on me every few minutes. Meanwhile, Nate and I chatted, held hands, decided what to order for lunch. I think we were the most excited people on that entire maternity ward for the free hospital food. And took selfies. I was feeling good, let me tell you. The contractions had subsided from their zenith of knife-stabbing accompanied by a stiletto grinding into the top of your foot pain to a dull throb, which was more of a light reverberation. "Oh, another contraction," I'd say, instead of which was my pre-epidural chant. Before actually going into labor, I'd thought I'd do yoga and center myself while perhaps delivering my child into my own arms in a warm tub of water, something the hospital offered. I almost brought my yoga mat with me, thinking maybe I'd give birth while in downward dog. After going into labor, conversely, I was unwilling to even get off of the bed and was ready to administer the epidural myself. Long about 11:30 a.m., Karen reported that the baby was laboring down nicely and that I should get ready to push soon. I straightened up in bed, butterflied my legs into the one yoga pose I did manage that day, and said, "Oh, pushing!" Being a person who gets drunk on one glass of wine, the epidural had me positively radiant. Karen came back to check dilation a few minutes later and suddenly turned frantic. She stopped smiling, reared her head back while keeping her arm on me, and told Nate to pull the emergency call button. He did, and nothing happened. It was broken. She then told him to run and get help. I was now moderately alarmed, although still feeling much like I do after a 3-champagne brunch accompanied by a small eggs benedict. Nate, being 6'2", bearded and imposing in the best of circumstances, apparently raised the alarm quite effectively, since a phalanx of doctors and nurses streamed into our once tranquil birthing suite, dropping clipboards and cups of coffee in their wake. As they wheeled me away, I couldn't understand what was happening, why we were on the move, or why Karen was sitting on the bed with me. From their urgency, I gathered I should be scared. They also left Nate standing helpless in our birthing suite, which I considered a bad sign for a hospital so progressive and water birth encouraging as this one. All I could see was the ceiling, which was one of those drop ceiling jobs with intersecting metal bars holding up pockmarked white tiles. I stared and stared at it, willing it to give me answers, I kept asking if the baby was okay, and then not understanding what I was being told. I couldn't make out the words. I heard the doctor yelling, "Faster, faster, faster!" At some point, three people crowded around my head to try to make small talk. There was a wide-ranging discussion about Boston versus San Diego weather and requests for me to squeeze someone's hand. After what felt like 2 hours, Nate burst through the operating room door, partially clad in scrubs with his little tissue paper hat on backward and two face masks, one to cover his beard. Then, seemingly out of nowhere, he was handed a baby. "Is that ours?" I asked. He smiled and brought the baby's face close to mine. Then they were gone, and I was back to looking at the ceiling. As I learned later, I was in and out of consciousness throughout the entire cesarean section, which explains why I thought no one was answering my questions. I'd wake up long enough to shout them out, and then pass out before hearing the responses. What felt like hours as I lay there prone, unable to move and unsure of what was happening to my body and my baby, was actually about 7 minutes. After my surgery was complete, they wheeled me back into the birthing suite where Nate was standing next to the window holding what I assumed was our daughter. She didn't look like I'd thought she would. I'd imagined her all those months as a toddler, a kindergartner, a Girl Scout, but somehow not as a newborn. She was so tiny and fragile and red and mushy, but she was dazzling and beautiful. I was captivated. Nate and Karen settled her on my chest to nurse, and she latched immediately, sucking away as if she were designed for this, this moment of connection and sustenance. I was the one wondering what to do, where to put my arms, whether she could breathe through her impossibly small nose that was now smashed against my chest. But she was wholly absent the anxieties of awareness. She was hungry, and she knew how to eat. We lay like that for almost an hour, me sleeping, my baby eating. When I woke up, Karen sat down next to my bed and explained what had happened. When she'd come to check my dilation one last time before telling me to push, she'd felt what's referred to as the midwife's curse, a prolapsed umbilical cord. This means the cord was protruding ahead of the baby, which is a life-threatening situation since, if untreated, the baby will lose oxygen. Karen immediately tried the first remedy of pushing the cord back inside next to the baby, but that didn't work. The only other remedy to prevent oxygen loss, and thus extensive brain damage, is an immediate cesarean section. Karen held the cord in to ensure the baby wouldn't lose oxygen until they could cut her out. That's why her urgency was so raw and why she had Nate run screaming into the hall. Protocol was no longer important. That's why they'd whisked me off without letting Nate catch up, and why the C-section was underway before I even understood what was happening. Thanks to Karen's swift response, our daughter was born perfectly healthy, boisterous and yelling with full lungs and an intact brain. My gratitude to Karen, our doctor, and the dozens of people who leapt into action that morning is deeper and more profound than anything I've ever felt. Cord prolapse is rare and occurs in fewer than 1% of pregnancies, but it doesn't feel rare when it happens to you. Since I'd had a C-section, we'd now be in the hospital for 4 days as opposed to two, which sounded like a fabulous plan to me. I was exhausted, heavily drugged, and in excruciating pain. We called our parents to let them know that they were now grandparents to Estelle Juliet Thames, the middle name my grandmother's, and we told each other that the worst was over. 2 days later, a doctor and a nurse woke us up in the middle of the night holding our daughter. Estelle, whom we quickly started calling Stella, had gone to the nursery for the night, and while there, the nurses observed what they called oxygen desaturation, which basically means she wasn't breathing properly and had turned blue. The doctor said they were admitting her immediately to the Level 2 NICU nursery for observation. Estelle's minuscule hands, feet, and chest were hooked up to 4 different monitors to track her vital signs. These tethers meant she couldn't be more than a few feet away from her crib at any time. And so Nate and I walked an expanse that, to me, felt like several miles from my room to the NICU every 2 hours so that our baby could nurse. Nate sandwiched a rocking chair in the corner behind her plastic box crib and moved the wires out of the way in order to nestle her on me to eat. Initially, the doctor planned to keep her for observation just overnight, but she continued desaturating, which kept extending her stay. She had to make it a full 48 hours with no desaturations before she could be discharged. While sitting in the NICU, nursing our mostly healthy, heavily monitored, full-term infant, we saw dozens of other babies in far worse condition and with dire prognoses. We felt guilty at how grateful we were, and we'd grip Stella tightly any time a new infant came in, as if their malady might be contagious. I was scheduled to be discharged after 4 days, but since Stella had to stay on, the hospital arranged for me to sleep in a room down the hall, not as a patient, but as a guest. My gratitude was now a deep well that kept expanding. Despite being a hospital, with all the bureaucracy that entails, they valued our desire to exclusively breastfeed and be close to our days-old child. Nate couldn't stay in the room since I had to share with another mother, so he trekked back and forth every day. He'd come at 6 a.m. and stay until 10 p.m., when I'd kick him out for fear he'd fall asleep while driving home. What I'd all but forgotten was the fact that we were in the midst of negotiating our offer on a homestead that was 150 miles away. Nate would pop out into the hospital corridor to answer calls from our real estate agent and lawyer. He let me weave a protective cocoon around Estelle in the noisy, bright NICU while he dealt with this other looming, pressing element of our future. She and I would sleep together in the rocking chair, and invariably one of us would shift and knock her mini-foot monitor loose, setting off a peal of beeps and alarms. In spite of how often we had to have the foot monitor reattached, our nurses redefined the concept of compassion. One of them helped me shower and knelt down to wash my feet since I couldn't bend over. They brought me juice and showed me how to bathe, diaper, and nurse Estelle, which was not part of their job, but which they did with love. They could not have been more giving had I been their own daughter. On our fifth day in the NICU, two nurses popped over with huge smiles and said it was time for our photo shoot. They stuffed Stella and her many cords into a giant Christmas stocking. It was early December, after all, a fact I'd forgotten. They positioned Nate and me cuddling our precious gift. At the last minute, they squirted sugar water into Stella's mouth to make her smile. To this day, it's my favorite picture of the three of us. After a week, Stella made it to the requisite 48 hours with normal breathing, so we were allowed to leave. I'd become so acclimated to life in the hospital with the meals provided, the nurses there to help me, and Stella under observation so I didn't have to worry about her, that I was almost hesitant to leave. I'd come to depend on this community of people to support me. Adding to my concern was the fact that the inspection on our homestead was scheduled for 11 a.m. the day of her discharge. Nate spoke with the doctor and was able to secure a rare 6 a.m. release for us, which would give Nate just enough time to drive us home from the hospital, install us in the house, and then drive the 3 hours to Vermont. When we walked through the front door, I saw that Nate had arranged the living room to meet our every need. He'd lined up our three different baby bouncers and swings, laid out a gigantic pile of blankets and towels, prepared a lunch for me in the fridge, and stocked the changing table with newborn diapers. I bought size 1 diapers in advance, but Stella was a peanut who wore newborns for a good 2 months. I still wasn't supposed to lift anything, and had a hard time sitting, standing, and walking on account of the major abdominal surgery I'd had. So I talked with my mom and sister, mothers of 3 children each, on the phone all day long, and gave them a minute-by-minute accounting of Stella's activities. I couldn't believe I was allowed to be alone with an infant who'd, up to this point in her life, been under constant surveillance by trained medical staff and a plethora of monitoring devices. I managed to keep her alive until Nate got home that evening, and he told me our dream was a go. The homestead had passed its inspections, and we were sailing toward closing. 14. The busiest 4 months of our lives. It was January 15th, 2016. I was freezing. It was sleeting. We were on what was soon to be our driveway of what was soon to be our Vermont homestead, and we were stuck. Or more accurately, our ancient minivan was stuck. The van went down the quarter-mile-long, hilly, ice-covered gravel driveway fairly easily, and it had even backed into the parking area below the driveway without incident. But now, it wouldn't go back out. Nate, Stella, and I, plus Gracie the Greyhound, had piled into the van at 6 a.m. that morning in Cambridge, along with an air mattress, a bassinet, a cooler of food, a box of wine, priorities, and a dog bed, and driven the 3 hours north to finalize the purchase of our homestead. The sellers had accepted our offer, the inspections had gone well, and here we were for the final walkthrough of the property with our real estate agent. I nursed a 6-week-old Stella sitting on the staircase, then changed her diaper on the kitchen counter, while Nate checked the barn, the tractor, which was included in the sale, and the house to ensure everything was in order, and that the sellers had performed the 2 repairs we'd requested. fixing the master bathroom toilet, and installing a radon mitigation system in the basement. Finding no flaws, we loaded our menagerie back into the van. No small feat, since the dog was supposed to sit next to the baby in the back seat and was forever overdoing her jump into the car and landing on the car seat. Nate turned the engine and we felt the tires skid underneath us. There was too much ice for our snow tireless van. After our real estate agent put some dirt under the wheels, we were able to squeal out of our parking spot. Nate gunned it up three quarters of what was about to be our driveway, but the van surrendered on the final hilly crest that weaves around a tree just before you reach the road. We'd known this driveway would be a pain because it was steep and long and our sole responsibility to maintain. But the pros of this homestead, the land, the gorgeous house, the pond, the high-speed fiber internet, and the good school district, all outweighed it. Or so we'd thought. The minivan was now entrenched on this hill like a dowager ensconced in her chair during a wedding reception's devolution into the chicken dance, unwilling to move in either direction. Nate got out to hike back down to the house to ask our real estate agent to call a tow truck since, naturally, we had no cell reception. Sitting in the passenger seat, I turned up NPR and the heat and reached into the back seat to pat the girls. As I hummed along to the Morning Edition theme song, the van started sliding backward on the ice. I jumped out of the car and released a primordial scream, the scream that mothers over millennia have screamed when their babies were about to be eaten by a woolly mammoth slash succumb to the plague slash slide off an icy driveway. I started to run behind the van to stop it with my body when Nate jogged up the driveway and grabbed me to prevent me from being run over. The van gently slid into a snowbank on the side of the driveway and came to a smooth stop. I ripped Stella out of the car and sat in the snow sobbing hysterically. In the span of 15 seconds, all the confidence I'd built this past month and a half that we were doing the right thing, that this homestead was the one, that we weren't crazy to move to the middle of nowhere with an infant, was shattered. Obliterated. I felt stupid, and not just for trying to bolt behind a moving car as opposed to climbing over into the driver's seat to steer like a rational person. We knew this 20-year-old minivan that lacked all-wheel drive and snow tires wasn't optimal for driving in snow, but we'd done it anyway. As Nate held me holding Stella in the 15-degree air on the side of the driveway, our Vermont native real estate agent managed to drive the car out of the driveway in what can only be described as a cannonball run. I cried and shook the entire drive to our lawyer's office for the formal closing and paperwork signing. Nate asked if I still wanted to go through with it. I hesitated. This episode encapsulated all my fears about this move, that we'd be out of our depth on such rural land, that we weren't prepared, and that there'd be no one to help if something happened to our baby. However, we'd spent so much time researching this decision that, despite my misgivings, I was confident this was the place. I also considered the alternative of not following this dream, of returning to the city, of living with all-encompassing regret. That was an even worse fate, so I said yes, but with the caveat that I never wanted to drive that car down that driveway ever again. And we didn't. It was now a full hour past our scheduled appointment time with our lawyer, the seller, a banker, and both real estate agents. We burst into the office a hot mess, me having only recently stopped crying, Stella in a carrier snuggled against my chest in her best imitation of a marsupial, and Nate clutching our 60-pound dog, who was wild-eyed from the trauma of riding in a car and climbing up the three flights of stairs to the office. I'm pretty sure they all thought we were crazy. Not crazy in a Fox-type way, but genuinely out of our minds. The papers were signed as our dog panted on the floor, and Stella nursed. The keys were handed over, and we even remembered to have our real estate agent snap a family photo of us. That night, we parked the van at the top of the driveway and hiked down to the house in the dark, lit by the flashlights I'd thrown into the car at the last minute. Camping out in our new home, with a fire glowing in the wood stove and Stella snoozing on her bassinet mattress on the floor, Nate and I toasted with the box of wine we'd brought and agreed that this was, in fact, it. We'd done it, or at least the first part of it, because that night was the start of the busiest 4 months I've ever endured. We'd be moving up to Vermont full-time in May, and before that happened, we needed to buy two cars, and I needed to quit my job. We needed to rent out our Cambridge house, have Nate work full-time at his office, build up my freelance business, and pack up all of our worldly possessions. With an infant. Replace minivan had been sitting on our to-do list for some time, but after its performance on the driveway, we hurried that line item along. Moving to the woods from the city wasn't merely a change in scenery. It was a sweeping lifestyle revamp. We needed two reliable cars instead of one geriatric van. There's no public transit in rural Vermont, and we had no desire for one of us to be unable to leave the property if the other one was out. Nate had been doing car research for years, so that when the time came, we'd be prepared to buy. That spring, we paid cash for a used Subaru Outback and a used Toyota Prius, which allowed us to achieve our dual goals of excellent gas mileage, via the hybrid Prius, and all-wheel drive, via the Subaru, for Vermont's snow and mud seasons. Paying cash in full for two cars just 3 months after having our first child and a month after buying a homestead without needing to first sell our Cambridge home was our extreme frugality in action. We'd saved for years by foregoing unnecessary luxuries and economizing on necessities so that we could do exactly this, spend on the things that mattered to us. Also, I'd be remiss if I didn't point out that buying a new car has to be one of the worst financial decisions humanly possible. Cars depreciate the minute, yes, the minute, they're driven out of the showroom, and the markup on a new car is egregious. A used car, on the other hand, allows you to let someone else suffer that initial depreciation while you get a vehicle that's still perfectly safe, drivable, and vastly less expensive. Want real numbers? Here you go. In 2016, we bought a 2010 Subaru Outback with 100,000 miles for $12,000, and a Toyota Prius, also a 2010, and also with just under 100,000 miles, for $9,000. Brand new in 2010, that Outback retailed for $26,790, and the Prius for $23,800. That means we realized a 55% discount on the Subaru and a 62% discount on the Prius. We spent $21,000 total on two reliable cars that were just 6 years old and in excellent condition, versus the staggering $50,590 price tag of new. And don't fool yourself into thinking you need a new car for the safety features or the all-wheel drive, because you can find all these amenities and more in cars that are just a few models earlier than the current. Owning a car at all is a luxury, and I'm of the belief that all luxuries, from chocolate to elective home renovations, should be paid for in full and with cash. If you can't pay cash, you don't get to buy it. In the spirit of keeping the cycle of used cars alive, we sold our 1996 Honda Odyssey minivan for $1,000 on Craigslist in Cambridge because it was still a great car, just not a car equipped for life in the rural wilds. That resale illustrates another cardinal truth about used cars. You can usually resell them at a rate that nets you a fairly reasonable return on your initial investment. You probably won't make all of your money back, but since the initial colossal depreciation already took place, your resale price will be much closer to the price you paid. This as opposed to the remarkable discrepancy between the price of a new car and its resale potential. Paying cash for cars is also a perfect illustration of the fact that frugality is a compounding game. By never having car payments or any other non-mortgage debt and the often exorbitant interest rates that go along with such debt, Nate and I have always been able to save at a high rate, which means we're able to avoid having car payments, which means we're able to save at a higher rate. It's a virtuous cycle of low spending and high saving that's self-perpetuating. The less money you need to live on, the more you save, and the less you need to earn. Plus, when you're paying off a car loan or other debt with interest, your money is compounding in your creditor's favor. When you instead invest that money in low-fee index funds, for example, your money is working for you and compounds in your favor. And it doesn't take all that much money to yield substantial dividends in the future. Since I've already gone there, let's do another example with real numbers. For this exercise, I'm going to use cable television, which has to be my all-time favorite budget scapegoat. Here's the premise. Would you rather watch TV or have $91,000? Permit me to explain. Let's say you spend $75 a month on cable. I'll grant you that doesn't sound like a huge amount of money on its own. But multiplied by 12 months, that's $900 a year on television. Now let's say you instead invested that $900 in low-fee index funds and realized a 7% return, which is considered an average annual market return over the long term. Imagine you kept that same $900 invested for decades, which is the wisest way to invest, and added $900 to your investments every year instead of paying for cable. In 30 years, your annual investment